Slides.
I have not booted the sucker up yet, but I think we should be.
Thank you.
Yes?
Oh, okay. You'll do it.
They'll call you. They're gonna read your email and I'll leave them to you too.
And then I just hit it. I only have two, so I'll just hit the address.
Just the arrow right there. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody just so crammed. Well, I get on the milk station part, so the wire is over packed.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm really early. Good.
Yeah, I get on that Ashby. It's not too bad.
You'll still be able to find some parking lots in the city. If I had lived in West Oakland, that's the thing. What I would give up and wait until the next
day.
Yeah. People just so.
That's why I speak
happy. People just so. Oh,
yeah. This is what you're probably getting. Makes me live. I mean, I'm not pushing it.
Good morning. Seeing all commissioners present, we're going to move on to item 2, the adoption of the agenda. Can I get a motion for the adoption of the agenda? All in favor? So moved. Item 3, adoption of the November 21st regular meeting minutes. Can I have a motion? All in favor? Item 4 is our executive director's report. Trent, Mr. Rohr.
Fixing my mic. Good morning, commissioners, and happy holidays. I have my report's somewhat lengthy, so settle in. I'll start at the federal level. Couple of things that aren't so great, and one that is actually really good for our agency. The first is around the public charge, and as you're aware, when the public charge rule was to be implemented, there were several filings for injunctions around the country to prevent the federal government from operationalizing it, and Three of them were upheld, which prevented, of course, the public charge rules from going into effect, or the change in the rules. Since then, however, earlier this month, two of the lower court injunctions, Ninth Circuit from San Francisco and the Fourth Circuit, lifted the injunction, meaning the feds could proceed. However, there is a third injunction that was a nationwide injunction in place by a district court in New York, and that one remains. So basically, there were three of them that were, you know, sort of holding the line. Two of them are now gone, and so we're waiting for the ruling on the third one. So the rule still is not in effect. It's just sort of, you know, indication perhaps that I hope not, but that maybe the basis for our injunctions might not hold legal water, but we'll see. Our communications, you know, this sort of the most important thing for us, of course, is to communicate out any changes to our clients and our community partners and prospective clients. So we're reviewing our updated frequently asked question document, and we'll send it out for translation. We just don't want sort of news report that the injunction has been lifted to translate into the communities that, that the public charge rule is in effect, or the changes are in effect, because they're not yet. The second action at the federal level that's not a good one has to do with our CalFresh, our SNAP program. And this did get a little bit of press, or actually got a lot of press, around, the headlines were around sort of reductions to food stamps, reductions to food support. The rule is a little more complicated than that, but basically what the rule that went into effect is doing is impacting our ability to exempt single adults without kids from the work requirement in order to receive CalFresh benefits. So as you know, we have been implementing this for over a year now and have been using our exemptions to prevent anyone from losing their CalFresh, whether or not they were participating in their required work activities. So no one has lost their benefits in San Francisco, which is in line with our vision for food support for families, for individuals. What this rule does, however, is it eliminates the backlog of exemptions in California and other states, which basically reduces our flexibility, or will reduce our flexibility to grant exemptions for from the work requirements. The rule has an effective date of April 1st, 2020, so it's not in effect yet. So what we're doing is sort of analyzing what does that mean given our caseload size, given caseload size in other counties that are subject to the ABOD requirement, because the entire state is not subject yet. It's only a handful of counties with very low unemployment rates, to see what the impact will be on ability to grant exemptions. We still, you know, maintain our stance, our belief that food support is, you know, a basic human right. It's an entitlement. It should not be linked to any work requirements or any other additional requirements other than simply being low income. And so we're going to keep pushing to maintain benefits for as many people as we can. However, so the exemptions go away, our flexibility could be limited. So we know that some legal advocates are lining up perhaps to file a lawsuit to prevent this. And again, it doesn't have an effective date until April, so we'll have some time. And I'll, of course, keep you informed on the progress there. Now, on the positive news out of the federal government, if you recall, I went back to D.C. in September with a group of child welfare leaders from across the country to lobby for mitigation for states and counties who are operating under a 4E waiver, and the waiver that expired at the end of September this year. For states and counties that were operating under the waiver, the expiration of the waiver could have the result of a really significant financial cliff, meaning the federal money that was flowing to us for 5 years as of September 30th, 2019, goes away. The impact in Los Angeles, for example, is about $220 million. So they, of course, were part of the delegation that went back. Our impact is smaller, yet it's still significant. It's between $5 and $7 million, perhaps. It fluctuates a bit. Pelosi's office was very, very engaged on this, and her lead staffer developed a piece of legislation that would mitigate this harm. And basically what the mitigation is called, the Family First Transition Act, it would provide 90% of what we otherwise would have received in federal dollars under the waiver in the first year, 75% in the second year, and then phased out from there into the new Family First Act. In addition, it would provide $500 million nationwide in one-time money, of which California's share is about $52 million. Our share is around $700,000 or so. That was the proposal, and when we went back in late September, they assured us that it was a bipartisan and bicameral supported proposal, meaning leadership in both the Senate and the House from both the Republicans and the Democrats, which is very, very unusual. So they assured us it was going to move forward. That was in September. Nothing had happened. Late last week, I believe, this Family First Transition Act was included in the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2020, which is basically the act to keep the federal budget going. And it was put in exactly as introduced, and because of the bipartisan nature, because of the leadership support of this, and the fact that they need to approve this act to continue the federal government's ability to operate, it's almost a sure thing that this will pass, which for San Francisco and for the state of California is excellent news. And, you know, Pelosi's office really played a huge role in this. You know, so of course, thanks to her. But you know, it was an interesting group of supporters. You know, states like Florida and, you know, allies that you normally wouldn't have, Florida, Indiana, and others all lobbying for this. So I think the fact that it was affecting so many states, both red and blue, really helped push it through. Hasn't passed yet, but it almost assuredly will. Now, at the state level, earlier this month, the County Welfare Directors Association, we had our annual legislative retreat, which basically establishes our priorities for the year for 2020. And there are a few I want to bring to your attention. And these are legislative or budget priorities, meaning CWDA will be the lead sponsor. We'll find authors, and we'll be, you know, in lockstep supporting them. And they're in three different programs. One is in CalFresh. The proposal here is attempting to address legislative, regulatory, and technological barriers for counties in California to enroll more people into CalFresh and to keep people on CalFresh. So issues of households who may be eligible not applying due to various barriers, and then even worse, recipients being discontinued because of requirements that they have to recertify throughout the year and missing those appointments or not submitting documentation. So the law, or the proposal isn't, of course, yet written, but the idea is to address those barriers to CalFresh enrollment with the idea of increasing the participation rate in California. Assemblyman and Budget Chairman Phil Ting has agreed to author this tentatively, which is great. Having the budget chair in the assembly authoring a bill is always a good thing. So that one's off to a really good start. The next priority is around CalWORKS. And if you recall last year, a bill that we had supported and that CWDA sponsored with other folks increased the amount of income a CalWORKS family could have and still maintain eligibility for benefits. So this is in recognition of a couple things. One, the higher minimum wage in California. And the second is the higher cost of living in California. The it's called the earned income disregard. The amount of earned income a family could receive and maintain eligibility for benefits had not changed in many, many years. And it did not change when the minimum wage was increased, and it certainly hasn't changed to reflect the higher cost of living. So that bill last year passed. So the disregard increased to will increase to $500 instead of $225, and then that will be ratcheted up each year, allowing, of course, families to earn more and stay on benefits, continue to receive their cash assistance, their child care support, etc. Coupled with that bill last year was that same change for applicants. Now, that did not pass and was stripped from the bill because of its cost. So this year we're pushing forward to increase the amount of earned income a family can have and still be eligible to apply for CalWORKS. Currently it's only $90. We're hoping to push it up to $500, again recognizing the higher minimum wage and the higher cost of living in California. And the third is really more of a funding issue, but it's a very big one, and it has to do with extended foster care, which was established by Assembly Bill 12 many years ago, about 7 years ago, I believe. And basically what that said is you could continue to receive foster care up to age 21 instead of age 18, which, of course, helps our young people transition into adulthood. When this bill went through, the funding structure held county costs at a fixed amount, meaning that we didn't have to bear the increased cost of providing foster care in future years for an increased population. It was capped. When the funding structure for child welfare changed and was realigned to counties, that the interpretation from the governor's office then under Governor Brown was that cap was lifted. So as a result, counties now bear the cost of that additional foster care support in a much higher way than we should have based on the initial statute in 2012. For us, it's about $4 to $5 million a year. And you know, we have that built into our budget, and it's the program is continuing to operate. However, in larger counties, they've actually stopped offering Assembly Bill or offering extended foster care because they can't afford it, San Bernardino and Riverside. And Los Angeles's cost exposure is probably about over $100 million at this point. So it's a budget initiative. It's a funding priority. And because some counties are now stopping enrollment into extended foster care, we now have sort of the programmatic and client impact of the funding shift. So that's the third priority for CWDA. Once we have authors, I'll continue to keep you up to speed on that. Earlier this month, we probably sent you the links to the articles on the diaper bank expansion. There was a front page story in the Chronicle on expanding our diaper bank to CalFresh parents. So just sort of an update on the number we've touched. Help a Mother Out, which is our nonprofit partner, since last month's commission meeting when the expansion was reported, we have, let's see, in October, November, they distributed 150,000 diapers to CalFresh recipients. And of the 490 clients they've served during that time, the majority actually were CalFresh. So they essentially doubled the number of diapers that they've given to low-income households and with children with kids under 3 years old. Family Resource Centers, which is a partner with us, has been giving very positive feedback. They've seen a significant increase in diapers distributed in OMI and in Viz Valley in their neighborhood centers. And then even at 1235 Mission Street, which predominantly serves single adults, but some families come through, they've distributed over 40,000 diapers in those 2 months. So this is really, this is an initiative that has really blossomed. And the front page news coverage, I think, is certainly worthy. And hopefully, our model will start to get traction in other areas of California and across the country. So in shifting gears now to our budget, we had our department head meeting with the mayor earlier this week where we got our budget instructions for the next two fiscal years. Remember, we're in a two-year budget now. What the controller's office and the mayor's office is projecting is a budget deficit for fiscal year 2021 of $195 million and a projected budget deficit in fiscal year 21-22 of $224 million. So combined, over $400 million deficit. This is largely due to slowing of revenue growth and an increasing of costs. So obviously, we're bringing in less money than we're giving out. Even though we've had extraordinary business expansion, the revenue has been largely, the large revenue has been property transfer tax, which, as you know, is a one-time sale of a large property, so it's hard to rely on that from year to year. We've relied on large fund balances, which is carrying over unspent general fund into the following year. And so the balancing has been, in part on one-time dollars. The cost growth is not surprising. Healthcare costs for employees, pension costs for employees, salary increases that the city was able to give in the labor agreements. So, and then some acute increased cost pressures for programs that are growing significantly, and most notably IHSS. Which the mayor's office pointed out, which are entitlement programs that the city nonetheless gets funding from the state, but we also have to contribute because it's an entitlement program. So given the deficit, our instructions were to reduce our general fund spending by 3.5% in fiscal year 2021, by another 3.5% in 2022, but the 3.5% for 2021 carries forward as well. So it's essentially 3.5% in budget year one, 7% in budget year two. We've received our monetary target from the mayor's office, and it's about $2.2 million. 3.5% of our discretionary general fund is about $2.2 million. Remember, our agency-wide budget is over $1 billion now. In federal, state, local dollars, but the cut is really only based on the part of the general fund that they consider discretionary, so non-entitlements, non-matching for other funding, and so it's $2.2 million, which, it's $2.2 million in isolation is a lot of money. It is, I think, very manageable to be able to meet that target without any service reductions, given our revenue picture and the like, but we'll certainly know more as we as we roll through our budget process and target the hearings before you in early in 2020. The mayor did also lay out her top budget priorities. Not surprisingly, it's around homelessness, shelter and services to unhoused San Franciscans, clean streets for everyone, and healthy, vibrant neighborhoods. And so to the extent that there is general fund to be spent and expanded once departments meet their targets, it's likely to go towards things like mental health support for our homeless, more housing, shelter, and the like. That's not to say we're not going to be able to expand spending in certain areas as well. If we meet our target and find other offsetting revenue, there's certainly room to expand in areas where we see need as well in our agency. So in the divisions now, starting in January, so very soon, the young adult expansion to full scope Medi-Cal, so this is for undocumented youth up to age 25, will be eligible for Medi-Cal beginning in 2020. So we're gearing up for that and working with Department of Healthcare Services on technological solutions to be able to do that in a fairly easy manner. In our Welfare to Work division, just want to highlight a couple things. One is our housing support program, which, as you know, has been very, very successful in providing housing subsidies to our CalWORKs families who are homeless. We've served 437 clients since the program began. What I want to highlight for you is that this program is now one of the rapid rehousing options in the universal intake system in the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing, in their coordinated entry system, which means that if a family comes in through coordinated entry, not through our office, and they happen to be on CalWORKs, they get referred to this program, which is just another way for families to avail themselves of supports that we can offer them. And then also in our Welfare to Work division, our annual Working Families Credit Program. So this year, this is the program that provides local dollars to low-income households when they file for federal taxes in order to encourage them to receive the federal earned income tax credit, as well as now the state earned income tax credit. The program now has shifted. We would provide the city dollars, the Working Families Credit, one time. Over this past budget year, we got funding to actually provide this on an annual basis. So now households who come in and file their taxes, even if they have received the Working Families Credit, it's $200 or $250. I think it's $250. They will now receive that even if they've received it before. And again, this is an incentive to apply for the bigger tax credit. The federal EITC is several thousand dollars. The state EITC can be $1,000 or more, depending on their circumstances. We are starting our free tax program late January, offered at four different sites: 1235 Mission, 170 Otis, 1800 Oakdale, and 3120 Mission. And then there's also free tax prep service through a virtual tax assistance model that will save clients wait time, allow them to do it online, and even sign their return digitally so they don't have to come in person and wait for their free tax services. Take a breath and some water. Lots of good news to share. So we were awarded just recently a two-year state grant for almost $1 million, $983,000, to conduct Medi-Cal outreach and application assistance. And so we're partnering with the Department of Public Health and on three strategies with this $1 million. The first is conducting application assistance at the behavioral health clinics that are operated through DPH. The second is partnering with UCSF and their preterm birth initiative. This is to pilot what they're calling the Pregnancy Villages program, which is a mobile clinic that are going into our lower income areas to provide Medi-Cal enrollment assistance to and prenatal services to low-income pregnant moms, with the idea that when you look at the preterm birth data, it's disproportionately low-income moms and low-income moms of color. And so the Pregnancy Villages will be targeting those populations, and we're going to accompany them to enroll them into Medi-Cal at the same time with these dollars. And then the third is expanding the existing partnership we have in our navigation centers and our homeless shelters to provide on-site benefit enrollment into Medi-Cal for homeless individuals.
Commissioner? Will this affect the in-home health services public authority?
The question, it was hard to hear from Commissioner Selma, was will it impact IHSS or in-home supportive services? They're already on Medi-Cal, and so it won't have any impact for them. However, if we do enroll folks into Medi-Cal who happen to be eligible for SSI and ultimately IHSS, then it would have an impact. Shifting into Family and Children's Services, we had our annual foster parent resource family holiday event this past Saturday. It was very well attended, over 350 people, lots of kids, distributed gifts to every family and all the children. The gifts were donated by a whole swath of very generous people and organizations. It was a really nice event to honor our resource families and have a nice party for their kids. We concluded our annual resource family approval state review. It's not really an audit, it's a review. And this is the, you remember under continuum of care reform, AB 403, we shifted the way we enroll and certify our resource families or foster parents. Everyone who was an existing foster parent or relative caregiver had to go through this process, as well as new and prospective resource families. This was a huge lift. County after county and statewide, there were huge backlogs. We're supposed to do it within 90 days. We were experiencing our own backlog. We have really, due to some technological improvements, but also leadership from the division, we've able to eliminate the backlog, and there were no issues or findings in the review. There were two very, very minor issues that had to do with paperwork, but they were very, very impressed with what we've been able to accomplish. So kudos to Joan Miller, our FCS director, as well as Sophia Isom, under which this program sits, for really coming up to speed on and getting everyone certified under RFA. It was a really heavy lift. And then lastly, I think I mentioned this a number of months ago, we're partnering with Department of Public Health, First Five, and a lot of Child Abuse Prevention Center and a lot of other nonprofits to look at a system of child abuse prevention in San Francisco. And part of that, we had the controller's office do an asset map, which basically says how many services are out there that can be loosely defined as child abuse prevention. And what they identified was 375 distinct programs or services that can be characterized as child abuse prevention. And so the initiative certainly is needed. And what the initiative will seek to do is to look at those 375 different initiatives and programs and try to get some better coordination, synergy around what they're doing, to see if there's duplication, to see if we're missing things, to see what the services are like, what is primary, what are the primary interventions, what are the secondary interventions, and really come up with a more, I think, seamless and better system for child abuse prevention in San Francisco. And this is really led by Katie Albright and Child Abuse Prevention Center from the nonprofit side, and then, of course, our agency, since that's our responsibility. So with that, I'll take a breath. Wish you all and all the staff happy holidays. Hope you and your families have a very safe and great holiday. And, of course, open it up to questions and comments.
Are there any questions from members of the commission? Last month, you were away.
I was.
Do you have any highlights? We saw pictures, but.
thank you, Commissioner. Yeah, sure. I'll share a few highlights. So I was invited, along with representatives from cities throughout the world, to attend Seoul, Korea's first annual International Care Conference. And the idea around the conference was Seoul is really trying to improve its system of care for kids and for seniors. And they invited sort of my counterparts from cities around the world, Stockholm, London, Tokyo, Vancouver, Honolulu, Madrid. I mean, I can go on and on. And it was very, very interesting to hear what all of our, Sydney, Australia, what all of our systems look like. And the idea was presenting all our different systems for seniors and children. I presented for children. have a dialogue with the Seoul government and nonprofits, really have a great exchange of ideas. And certainly the city of Seoul and the mayor attended the entire event. It was very appreciative. I think learned a lot. But I also, of course, hearing from my counterparts from around the world what their systems look like, learned a lot as well. So I was very honored to be invited to attend, and it was a great trip.
Were you the only one from the United States?
Oahu. Honolulu was represented. So the only one from mainland, yes. And the mayor of Seoul is actually coming out here in early January and wants to see, he and his delegation wants to see some of what I talked about at the conference. So I don't know if you know, Seoul is a sister city of San Francisco, and so they exchange, a fair amount. And so he and his delegation will be coming out, I think, the second week of January. So once that's finalized, I'll certainly let you all know. It'd be great to have you join us as well. So thank you for asking, Commissioner.
Any other questions? Thank you. Moving on to item 5 is our Manager of the Year Award. So the Commission is pleased to honor Dan Kelly, Planning Director, as the 2019 Manager of the Year. Many leaders are both good implementers as good visionaries. Few leaders are both. Dan Kelly has uniquely demonstrated both qualities over his 12 years as HSA's planning director. To name just a few recent examples, Dan has demonstrated both extraordinary vision in developing the agency's social equity initiative and the ability to implement that vision with a range of innovative pilots and partnerships. Through Dan's leadership, HSA has begun using our unique touch points with San Francisco's low-income population, many of whom are geographically, socially, or economically isolated from the city's mainstream. To increase access to the city's assets, such as parks, camps, and cultural institutions, Dan and his team of extraordinary planners developed the agency's social equity vision, built internal excitement and cross-departmental partnerships, and initiated a number of pilot projects to put the ideas to practice. He partnered with the mayor's office and the treasurer's office to launch Museums for All, which provided free admission over the summer when children are out of school to more than 15 museums and cultural institutions for residents who receive public benefits. In partnership with the HSA Communications and Economic Support and Self-Sufficiency Division, Dan organized a mass mailing and text messaging campaign and personally visited CBO partners and family resource centers to spread the word about the opportunity. Through the combined effort, the California Academy of Sciences had over 10,000 admissions from the public benefit recipients this summer. And Cal Academy, the mayor's office, and the city's other cultural institutions are so excited about the results that they have decided to extend the program year-round, offering public benefit recipients free access to San Francisco museums and cultural institutions throughout the year. The same creative sense of purpose and deep dedication to San Francisco's lowest income residents are behind Dan's idea and now the agency's practice to provide free diapers to aided parents with children under the age of 3 in partnership with the nonprofit Help a Mother Out. Dan's vision, practical knowledge of program administration, and data analysis are also poured into the many grant proposals he has developed. As example, Families Moving Forward, Housing Disability Advocacy Programs, CalWORKs Housing Support Program, and just this week, the Family renumification program vouchers, resulting in millions and millions of dollars to further HSA's mission in enabling us to stand out as a national innovative leader in anti-poverty work. Dan is both research-driven and a person-centered, committed to understanding the need of our clients and how we can better serve them by taking with them and analyzing reams of data. He has forged partnerships to creatively match administrative data and uncover service gaps and areas of concern vulnerability. For example, Dan was behind a seminal study of at-risk families in 2005, which revealed that the majority of children involved in public systems, including child welfare, mental health, and juvenile justice, lived within walking distance of just 7 street corners in the city. 6 of those 7 corners were in or adjacent to public housing developments. Inspired in part by this research, former Mayor Gavin Newsom decided he would make public housing redevelopment a signature priority in his administration, which we now know as Hope San Francisco. Dan spends Saturdays writing up his creative ideas, reaching out to partners, conducting community focus groups, or knocking on doors to let public housing residents know about a new early enrollment program for summer camps that he helped forge. Dan draws amazing talent to the planning division. He inspires and mentors his team of planners and project managers. He cares about them, advocates on their behalf, and helps them grow into leaders in their own right. Dan is a kind, empathetic person. His contributions to the agency and our clients are deep and far-ranging. He is a humble, quiet leader who prefers to extol credit on others. But today, it is my pleasure to honor Dan Kelly as the 2019 Manager of the Year. Excuse me, Trent Rohr is going to make some comments.
If I could say just a couple things. Sorry, Dan, I'm going to out you. So I called Dan on Friday to let him know that he was selected. And I called Dan on Friday to let him know he was selected. And the first thing he says was, you know, I don't really like this kind of stuff. Is it, the better thing is, isn't there a younger manager who's more deserving? So, Dan, sorry. But what you've done with the agency this past year and really in your career here is 100% worthy of this recognition. Commissioner Kahn went through the in great detail all of it that you've contributed to the agency, but just a couple other things. In his spare time, he has served, I think, the past 8 years as chair of the San Francisco Foster Youth Fund, which of course is our worker-led initiative to raise money to give for foster youth, send them to camps, get them prom dresses, et cetera. And so that, of course, takes a lot of time. When we were in Denver, he was presenting for his work with Recreation and Parks at a conference in Denver. Rather than seeing the sites or whatever in Denver, what Dan chose to do is make connections with our colleagues at the Denver Human Services Agency, or Colorado, I guess. Took a tour, met with people, and then brought them back here a couple months later to share ideas, you know, which is sort of always going the extra mile and really caring about our mission and what we do. And then lastly, and this also creates more work for Dan, is very often other department heads or nonprofit directors will ask if Dan can do this, this, and this. We had a meeting and juvenile probation director said, hey, we need to look at, you know, X, Y, and Z, usually do with data. Can Dan Kelly do this? So the fact that other department heads know who Dan Kelly is really is a testament to your work your dedication, and really, you know, obviously your reputation. And so, Dan, sorry, but congratulations. certainly well deserved.
His name is on the front of this building, and he knows so much about the history of this department and the history of the city that I just love talking to you and sitting with you and treasure our friendships, and thank you very much. I wanted to thank Susie also, who's been such a supportive supervisor. She's always encouraging me to be creative, to not hesitate to share ideas, and she doesn't blink when I come to her with some crazy ideas and say, you know, hey, shake the grapevine, get our clients talking about us. Could we have, like, out on the plaza when they come in, we have a mariachi band? And she says, okay. She doesn't blink. I haven't talked to her yet about the guy I found who walks on stilts and makes balloon animals. And I'll get people talking, I know. But thank you so much for all of your support. I think the thing that's kind of awkward for me in this is, you know, my philosophy of managing, I've shared this quote before from Casey Stengel, who was a Hall of Fame baseball manager. And he said that managers get paid for home runs that other people get. And I have a team of sluggers that I get to lead. Strange to get credit for all the work that they're doing. I think the thing I'm proudest of is just having hired all of you and being able to bring you into the ACC. And I'm just so grateful for your work. And I know that wherever you go, you're going to be leaders in whatever you're doing. And I'm just so proud of you. I wanted to share some of the home runs. Some of these things have never been done before by any local welfare agency in the nation. There's really amazing, amazing work there. So I'm very, very proud of all that you guys have done and feel like I'm up here on your behalf. So, you know, I see us as being, you know, we all share this vision. Community. And we have our ups and downs, but we you know, this purpose is just requires us to be the best of each other. And that this work is so hard, it also requires us to be supportive of each other. And none of us is working alone. We're all depending on each other. So Trent mentioned the microbit. And I'm so pleased that Stars in charge of the inventory, stocking the shelves, receiving the shipments. Without his hard work, the diaper bank would just fall apart. And I'm so grateful you're here. The Museums for All, the social inclusion work. I'm so glad that Grace is here today. The mailroom crew. I'm really proud to be a part of that work, and I'm really proud to be a part of this community. Thank you.
Thank you once again, Dan. Yeah. Item 6 on our agenda, the consent calendar. Does anyone want to remove an item for individual discussion? If not, can I have a motion to approve?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
So moved. Item A. John Tsutakawa. This is requesting authorization to modify multiple grant agreements with nonprofit services to provide to apply minimum compensation ordinance MCO funding increases.
Good morning, President Khan, commissioners. I'm John Tsutakawa, Director of Contracts. So the Human Service Agency requests authorization to amend specific grants for adjustments as part of the minimum compensation ordinance in the total amount of $252,800. For the department, this impacts 15 grantees and 25 separate grants. And this is something new, but kind of similar to the cost of doing business adjustments that we make. So the minimum compensation ordinance raised the nonprofit minimum wage for nonprofit workers to $16.50, and that was effective July 1st, 2019. At the same time, the mayor and the Board of Supervisors set aside $5.8 million to address costs of the MCO ordinance citywide for fiscal year 19-20. In July 2019, the Controller's Office conducted a citywide application process in which the nonprofits requested adjustments to the grants to reflect the increased costs. And the process not only looked at the salaries that were below a $16.50 rate, but also at the salaries immediately above them. Because raising the lowest salaries creates pressure, or what they call compaction, on the positions immediately above them, mainly like supervisors or staff wages that nonprofits have. From this process, the controller's office determined specific amounts to be allocated to nonprofits that were impacted by both minimum wage and compaction. And so at this point, HSA will be modifying those grants that were allocated funds to the process. And with your approval, we'll begin to work with the grantees and begin to change their budgets to reflect those. I'm glad to answer any questions you may have regarding this process. Yeah.
181 applications were taken?
Citywide.
Of those, how many are being responded to?
I don't know how many citywide. For our agency, it's 15 within the HSA that are covered by the HSA Commission, and I think it was 40 under the DOS Commission that were impacted.
So 55 agencies.
Yeah.
What does that mean in terms of the catchment? How many agencies have really been impacted that we were unable to help? Do we have any knowledge?
That we were unable to help?
Yeah.
So the idea was to impact all agencies that applied. That had salaries basically below $25 an hour. And so they brought the staff that were below $16.50 up to $16.50, and then if you had staff that are immediately above that range and agencies applied, they would basically get about a dollar per hour increase to those. And there were some agencies that all they got was compaction. They actually didn't have any staff, but the city recognized that if you're raising the compaction salaries of some agencies, that's going to impact retention and competitiveness of other agencies that have staff around the same level. There were a few agencies, I think, that made a choice not to apply because they figured they wouldn't get money at the 1650, but they probably would have got some money from the compaction. And so I think that's something we'll look at. We sent out multiple contacts, emails, notices, as well as the controller's office to encourage people to apply to it.
I was just musing on sustainability and what does this mean over if we aren't able to handle 60 agencies and there are really 200 out there.
Well, I think the larger number actually is citywide. So it's not just us, but DPH, MOHCD, DCYF. There's other agencies that work with nonprofits that they don't, and they also got money, like homeless. And so the idea was to impact all the nonprofits the city works with through contracting.
So moved.
Second, but I would like to live up to my Curious George reputation and ask you to provide a little more explanation on the compaction effect.
Okay, so the idea is that say I'm a staff person that's earning $16 an hour, and so I'm going to be brought up to $16.50. But let's say my supervisor is earning $16.75. So they were actually earning like 75 cents or a dollar more than me. Because I get a bump, then they're only earning 25 cents more than me. So the idea was to raise them a little too, because when you raise the bottom, you start closing the gap with the people immediately above, mainly supervisors, but you know, other staff that are in kind of comparable classifications.
Is there a standard for that? What the compaction rate would be if you take 80% of the next person above, you get 80% or you get 50%?
Yeah, so most of the staff below were being raised by a dollar or whatever it took them to get them to $16.50. On pretty much everybody above within that range of $25 and below got a dollar raise. Now when it's actually applied at the agency level, they're going to get this sort of sum of funds and they can figure out how to allocate. Minimally they have to make sure people are $16.50, but how they're going to distribute among the other staff is part of their decision of how it works with their salaries.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you.
Don't move. Thank you. Item B, Irina Kadantseva. How did I do pronouncing that? Pardon me? Oh.
It's the Knowles Foundation.
Okay. Moving on to Item C. You just changed names. Okay, so I skip B. Okay. I'm sorry. It was a typographical printing problem. Calling on Robin Love for the Knowles Foundation.
Good morning, President Khan and fellow commissioners. I'm pleased to be here today to see you. Happy holidays and all that good stuff. I'm here today to seek your authorization to proceed with a new contract with FD Knowles Foundation for the reservation of two set-aside beds for non-minor dependents, our 18 to 21-year-olds who are in extended foster care, who present to us as homeless or at imminent risk of homelessness. As you guys are aware, and as Trent has talked about, homelessness is a big issue in San Francisco. For our non-minor dependents, identifying placements within San Francisco can take up to 30 days, and it is often a challenge for our STU supervisors and for our staff to identify safe and appropriate placements. CDSS, as your commission memo indicates, recently issued an ACL, ACL 1905 in October, that actually mandated counties to address the issue of non-minor dependent emergency placements. This is our response to that mandate. Over the last year, our SDU team has begun to track homelessness and incidents of homelessness with our non-minor dependents. In fiscal year 18-19, 33 non-minor dependents ages 18 to 21 presented as having at least one incidence of homelessness. As mentioned, it can take up to 30 days to find these placements. We identified FD NALS for a number of reasons to participate in this pilot project, which we will be monitoring closely. FD NALS was selected, one, because they have collaborated with us over a number of years, 10 years, providing transitional housing services. They are also a licensed transitional housing provider and have met the CCL standards. The site is actually very close to 170 Otis. It's at 131 Persia Street, and they have the ability to set aside two beds for us, and its close proximity to 170 Otis makes it really important for our after-hours and swing shift staff if non-minor dependents come to our attention late in the evening. All of the non-minor dependents participating in this program will have access to the same services as the three San Francisco youth who currently reside at the facility. We also selected FD NALS because of its ability, or as an organization, to really be responsive and adapt a program model over the next year so that we can really learn and capture what's needed in terms of responding. This is part of FCS's comprehensive response to be more coordinated when it comes to issues of this. We are working closely with HSH as well as the local coordinating homeless board in terms of our provision of services. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have, and Tina from FD NALS is here as well.
How close to the 90-day limit are most of our, or seeming are most of our patients or clients? How much time do they need? Are they needing all 90 days?
Our plan is hopefully to not need the whole 90 days. As mentioned, if it's transitional housing or a SILT placement, those take longer because in addition to just moving the non-minor dependent, they have to go through an orientation, intake, and assessment process. I put a lot of pressure on our providers to turn these applications around in 14 days, but that is not always the case. Because this is a licensed THP, FC, and MD provider, as soon as we place the young person, we can actually draw down on 4E payments because it's a licensed placement. So our goal is to offset some of that. So we know that in some cases with higher needs youth, it might take a little longer. And when I say higher needs, if we were on a continuum of 1 to 10, around a 5 or a 6, because our real high needs youth need to be in a more supportive structured placement. So we don't plan to take the whole 90 days, but we wanted to have that wiggle room, particularly for special populations like LGBTQ. Sometimes it takes us a minute to find a safe, appropriate placement. As you know, our data tells us that 60% of our non-minor dependents are actually placed out of county, but because we export so many young people, we often don't get the reciprocity of housing placements. And other counties are struggling as well, so they're looking, as always, to San Francisco to learn from our model to see if this is something they can adapt. So ideally, not 90 days, but in some cases, on the high end, we might take the whole 90 days. But if they're in there, those would be actual placements. So we wouldn't be using our general fund. We'd be saving those funds and actually working with foster care eligibility to get the placement forms in so we can draw down on that federal aid.
Any other questions? Can I have a motion for approval?
I'm curious as to why you single out history of fire setting. Is that something that history of fire setting? Those people are not eligible.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, obviously not common, but some, unfortunately, kids or youth in foster care, some of their behavioral issues exacerbate to, fire setting is something we've seen in the past. Yeah, it's certainly not common, but we've seen it, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's destructive behavior like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is there a second? All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you.
Now, Community Works West, Irina Kadantseva. How did I do?
Thank you. That's perfect. Good morning, President Kahn and commissioners. My name is Irina Kadantseva. I'm a program analyst with Family and Children Services. And I'm here today to seek your authorization to modify and extend the agreement with Community Works West program for additional funding for this current fiscal year, an additional 2 years from January 1st, 2020 to June 30th, 2022 for the provision of visitation and support services for incarcerated parents in San Francisco jail system. In August of last year, in 2018, the Commission approved additional funds to increase staffing for this grant. That additional funding will be annualized and extended for this in this commission action. Community Works West has partnered with Family and Children Services since July of 2012, providing court-ordered visits between incarcerated parents and their children who are involved in child welfare system. The program also provides parenting classes to incarcerated parents and facilitates resource connections and linkage support to available services within San Francisco County jail system. This program has consistently met their annual contract objectives and outcomes and continues to implement innovative ways to meet their needs, the needs of the clients they serve. Our staff, Family and Children Services staff, has also noted the value of these services to families and appreciate the collaborative partnership. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have regarding this request, and I thank you for your consideration.
Any questions from the commission? Can I have a motion for approval? All in favor?
Aye.
So moved.
Thank you. Happy holidays.
Thank you. Calling on Brendan Lim, item D, event page translation for a new total of $82,500. Brendan, thank you.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Brendan Lim. I'm actually here to discuss items D, E, and F. Would you like to go individually or?
Well, we have to vote on each one, but.
Okay.
Can you speak into the microphone a little more? Thank you.
Sorry. I'm requesting authorization to modify the existing contract, adding $30,000 to Avant Page Translations, and this modification is necessary to meet our legal obligations to provide meaningful access to clients. This is a obligation under federal, state, and local law and ordinances. These contracts to provide language services are to enhance and supplement our internal language resources to provide services to clients.
Can I have a motion for approval of item D?
So moved.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you.
I'm also here for item E. This is also a request to modify and add $30,000 to Trust for Language Services for similar reasons as the previous item. And this is actually for translation of documents as opposed to in-person oral interpretation.
Any questions? Yeah, second? All in favor?
Aye.
So moved. Thank you.
And finally for item F.
Yes, go ahead.
International effectiveness, we're asking to add $170,000. And International Effectiveness Center is for oral interpretation, which our staff utilize in our buildings as well as for programs that are doing home visits as well.
Any other questions?
Just a question, just overall.
Yes.
Are these increases for the remainder of this period?
This is from January 1st, 2020 to 21.
Oh, next
year. Yes.
So we're adding because we believe we're going to have more caseload.
We're adding because of caseload as well as based on our utilization of this current year.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
So moved. Thank you. And I see there is no public comment, so our meeting is adjourned.
Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, blessed be the season of life be upon you all.
He hasn't done it.
Oh, yeah, that's online.